21. All right. The title here, A Wonderful Future. We've been looking at this, and from the very beginning, our theme said things are bad. They're going to get worse, but in the end, victory is assured. Well, here's the victory, okay? Here's the part that we're looking forward to. The final battle has been fought and has been won. We saw that last time. And so now, this is a picture of the reward. What do we have to look forward to? When all of this occurs, then what? And so this is a picture that John is shown of what we can expect for eternity to be like. Now, one of the things that we've been reinforcing over and over again throughout this study that's vitally important in this part also is that we have to look at all of these things symbolically, okay? They are not, I don't believe, intended to be literal in the understanding of some of the these particular things. Look at them symbolically and look at what do those symbols represent. What is, and for this part of it, I'd suggest to you to look at it in terms of what is the overall picture that is being shown here, and what does is that picture want to tell us? Okay, rather than trying to look at each individual specific thing. So, chapter 21 begins, John saying, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there is no longer any sea." Now, we talked about in a previous study we were doing in our worship time about heaven. Y'all recall that? And we were talking about really this particular part. What is heaven really going to be like? Okay? And this whole idea of a new heaven and a new earth. Again, there's a lot of teaching out there right now where folks are saying, oh, it's going to be, you know, basically this earth is going to be restored and everything's going to be redone. There are some religious groups out here right now that are teaching that you can live forever in paradise on earth. And so basically, this is heaven. Only 144,000 people actually are going to be in heaven, okay, according to these teachings. The rest of us are going to live forever here in paradise on earth. So earth is going to be somewhat changed to be a paradise, but it's still going to be this physical kind of a world. No, it's not, okay? It's not. It's going to be changed. It's going to be changed. Now, what is it all going to look like? Don't know. Is it going to have the same properties, this new heaven and new earth, that the present earth and heaven have? Probably not. Why? Because it'll all be a spiritual realm rather than a physical realm. The properties that we exist in today are required because it is a physical realm that we live and exist in. But if we go back to some things we looked at earlier, when the resurrection comes, what kind of body are we going to have? Spiritual. A spiritual body, not a physical body. So are you going to have flesh and blood? No. Are you going to need to breathe air? No. Well, what are you going to breathe? I don't know. I don't know how that's going to be. What does God breathe? What do the angels breathe? I don't know, okay? I think the main thing is, don't worry about those kinds of things.
Don't sweat the little
things. Yeah, because here's the overall view I look at it as. It's going to be so glorious and so grand, we're not going to be concerned about those things. Whatever God has planned and however that's going to be, you're going to like it, okay? You're going to like it. And I think that's the overall picture that we need to be seeing here in this chapter here. Whatever it is, you're going to like it. It's going to be grand and glorious, but it will not be a physical world that we live in. So what is it going to look like and so forth? John goes on to say, and I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. Okay? What is this holy city going to look like? That he's going to be describing it here to us. But what is this part, this idea of this being adorned as a bride for her husband? What is the picture there that God wants us to envision?
It's going to be pretty. It's going to be
okay.
Perfect.
Okay. All right.
Sounds like a wedding to me.
All right. Sure. It's going to be grand and glorious. Whatever it is, whatever it actually looks like, it's going to be magnificent. Okay, it's going to be just mind-boggling. Okay, and then he says, "I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and He will live with them.'" Okay, hold on just a second. I got to switch my papers here. He will live with them, and they will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. All right? So, hey, good morning. So, this brings up the question, where is heaven? Where is this place going to be? Where do we typically think of when we think of heaven? Okay, that's, I think, the correct answer, but typically when we think of heaven, don't we typically think of up there? You know, and I think, you know, rightly so, the Bible oftentimes speaks of, the heavenly realms and so forth, and we typically think of it's up there on the other side of the stars where we can't really see it. But I think the correct answer is, and I think this brings that out, is what Tracy just said. Where is heaven? It's where God is. Okay, and what does he say here that's going to be about? It's going to be the dwelling place of God and His people. Okay, so wherever God is, that's where His people are going to be, in other words. All right, so we need to understand heaven, again, not so much as a physical place, all right, but as what?
A spiritual
abode wherein is the dwelling of God. Now, having asked that and look at that, does that give us any kind of an idea of what hell's going, where is hell going to be? Say that again, Wes. Where God is not. Where God is not. Okay? In other words, outside of God's abode.
And the theory that there's going to be like a new earth and a new heaven and the two separate places, I mean, that can't really be because of God's in the heavenly realm and then you've got these people on earth that are supposed to be, you know, enjoying a good life, but God's not there, then what is the point?
Yeah, I agree. So the dwelling place of God is heaven. Okay? And wherever that is and whatever it is, okay, those who belong to God, as we're going to see here as we continue reading on, are going to be with Him. Now, but all of that apparently is making up part of the new heaven and the new earth. Okay? Everybody following so far? All right. So, we begin then looking at and seeing some of the characteristics of this new heaven and this new earth, this dwelling place, the abode of God and His people. How does He describe that as being? Okay? He says, verse 4, He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for what? What does it say here? The old order of things has passed away. What does that mean? There's not going to be any more crying, no more death, or mourning, or pain, or anything like that. The old order has passed away. Absolutely. Absolutely. You think about all of those things in terms of the pain, the death, and so forth. That's all part of physical attributes of this physical world we live in. Okay? Yeah, there's some other things, and I think it does allude back to the way things were in the beginning. There are some other things specifically that we'll talk about here, but also in chapter 22, in the final part about the tree of life. Okay, so yes, I think there's a tie-in with those things to the way things began. In the time of creation. Okay? When God created everything originally, everything that He created, what did He say about it? It was good. Okay? So when this new heaven and this new earth are all brought together, what are they going to be?
Good.
Okay? They'll be even better than good because they won't be physical. They'll be spiritual, and will never end. Dale?
One thing that I've read, too, is that where it says there's no more sea, mm-hmm. the sea separates.
Separates, right. Right.
And nobody would be separated from
God. Exactly. And more importantly, not separated from God. Okay? All right? Good. Anything else there? Okay, so there's not going to be any more death. Not going to be any crying, no more pain, no more tears even. You know, we sing, one of the songs we sing a lot is what? No tears in heaven, right? Is there going to be anything to cry about? No. No. Not at all. Everything is going to be grand and glorious. There will be nothing, in other words, to cause anyone, and I think this is the most important aspect of this, nothing to cause anyone to long for anything more. Okay? Beyond that. It'll be a situation, a circumstance where that is so different from now. You know, right now we all long for what? This, right? Why? Because there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of death. All of that is part of this. And so we now, in this present time, we long for the time where there won't be any of this. Well, when this is here, there'll be nothing to cause anyone to long for anything else. How's that sound to you?
Perfect.
See? No need to be wondering and hoping that something, you know, this is going to get better, you know. At some point, I won't have to experience this anymore, or any of those things that we think about now. It will be so amazing. There'll be no reason to long for anything else. Okay? So I think that's this idea. That you don't have to worry about any of those things. No tears, no pain, no death, no sorrow, nothing. Because all of those things tend to cause us to long for better times, don't they? Mm-hmm. There won't be anything else to long for in this, okay? Verse 5. Okay, let me see here. So that old order of things has passed away. Right? No longer going to be like that. It's going to be new. All right? He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. All right? So, when something is new, what does that necessarily require? If it's new, then it is different from the old. Thank you. All right? It is different from the old. Why else would you go and buy a new car? Okay? Why? Because it's different from the old one. If you didn't want it to be different, just keep driving the one you have, right? All right? The idea is it's different. And so this is going to be very different from the old. Again, as we started out, how different? What's it going to be? I don't know. Okay? But I can promise you this, you will not get there and look at it and go, gee, I wish they would have done this. I wish maybe these clouds were a little bit, you know, no. Again, there will be nothing to long for. Nothing that we will not be satisfied with, and even more than satisfied. You say, it will be new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. Right? It is done. Words said by Jesus on the cross. Okay, what's the difference between those words of Jesus on the cross and these words? It is done. Yes. What Jesus referred to on the cross was what? What was finished?
The Old Testament.
Okay, the Old Testament, but also his mission of salvation. Okay, that was done. Nothing else needs to be done to secure man's salvation. It's finished. Okay? But as we saw in the last several chapters, but especially in the last chapter here in chapter 20, the final battle has been fought and it's been won, so it is finished. It's done. Okay? You know, stick a fork in it, it's done. All right? There's no need to work on it anymore. No need to cook it any longer. It's done. Right? And so, again, one of the broad biblical teachings that we oftentimes talk about is the idea of different ages or dispensations in the Bible. Y'all familiar with that? Okay, what are there? Three of them. What are they? The patriarchal age, which basically describes what?
Patriarchs and fathers.
Okay, the fathers of the family and God dealing directly with the fathers of the family, right? And so it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all of them. So then from the patriarchal age, we move to the Mosaic age, okay, which is from Moses and giving of the law, okay, up until when? Till the time of Christ, which brings in the Christian age. All right? But there's only three ages. So what happens after the end of the Christian age? It's done. Okay? It's done. That's what this, I think, is referring to. There's no more age after this. There's no more, you know, another time period, and that goes back to the things we discussed in the previous lessons here about the millennial and, you know, premillennialism, and there's going to be this thousand-year reign and then all this. No, no, it's not. Why? Because it's done. Okay? It's done. When the victory is won, the final battle is fought, it's done. Okay? And so there is no more time. There's no more age. There's no more other dispensations. There's no other chances or any of those things. It's done. Okay? What God initiated from the very beginning in the story of creation is now finished. Okay? It is complete and done. He says, then, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And that's what the Alpha and the Omega are, the beginning and the end. There will be nothing else beyond that in terms of the physical world that we live in and God working salvation and His plan to save His creation and all those. It's done. And it was accomplished by who? By the Alpha and the Omega. Okay? The Alpha and the Omega. He started everything, and He finishes everything. All right? He started creation, did He not? When? In the beginning. Okay? In the beginning. How long was that between the time that, you know, God existed where He decided to start creation? Say that louder. There was no time. Okay? He always has been and always will be. He is the Alpha and the Omega. Okay? He is then the completion of all things. All right? Okay, yeah, the last part of this on the very bottom down there. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. Okay? Several different references that we have, especially in the Gospels, of this idea of being thirsty and also of the water of life. Okay, the woman at the well, okay? What does Jesus tell her? This conversation starts out by saying what? Will you give me something to drink? Okay? How is it that you, a Jew, could ask me, a Samaritan woman, for something to drink? And what does Jesus say? If you knew who it was that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you what?
Living
water. Okay? Living water. Because that's what God provides. But in order for us to really understand and appreciate that living water, what do we have to do? Go back over to Matthew. The Beatitudes. Matthew chapter 5, what does he say? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for what?
Righteousness.
For they shall be filled. When's that filling going to take place? So for those who thirst, he says, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. We have that to look forward to. This is going back just a little bit. All who are, I've got to find it on here. He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. And he who overcomes what? overcomes, you know, all of the temptation, the evil, all of those things that would attempt to pull us, you know, to direct us away from God. In other words, those who remain faithful to Him. Okay? He tells us, Paul the Apostle tells us what? Be faithful for how long? Unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Okay? So we need to, you know, that's part of this reference. Again, go all the way back to the beginning of our study. What was the purpose, at least in part, for John seeing this vision and writing it down?
To be uplifting to the Christians.
Okay. To the Christians who were dealing with what?
Persecution,
trials, and tribulation, so forth. And the whole idea was, don't give up, right? This is what you're going to go through, but this is what you have to look forward to. Things are bad, they're going to get worse, but in the end, the victory is assured, right? That's been the message all along. So here, in this final part of it is, to those who don't give up. See? This is what you have to look forward to. If you don't give up, he who overcomes will inherit all of this. Okay? Paul talks about us being heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. Okay? When you talk about being an heir, what do you get as an heir? An inheritance. Okay, and that's what he's speaking of here. Okay? We have an inheritance to look forward to. But who's going to receive that inheritance? Only, how does Paul refer to it? Those who are what? Sons of God. Those who are his children will receive the inheritance. Because why? That's who generally receives an inheritance, right? You are an heir, so you get an inheritance. And so those who don't give up, those who hold true, have an inheritance to look forward to. What is that inheritance going to look like? He's going to share with that with us in just a moment here. But before we look at that, there's another warning here that's kind of placed right into this. Again, keep in mind, as we just said a moment ago, the purpose is to do what? Bring encouragement to those who are struggling against, you know, the trials and tribulations and so forth, those who are tempted to give up, okay? And to those who are not living the way they should be living, okay? Look at the warning that he gives in verse 8. Right? But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This he describes as the second death. So again, here's a warning, okay, that those who are remaining faithful, those who aren't giving up, those who are maintaining to the end, they're going to get an inheritance that everybody else, they're going to be cast into the lake of fire. And this part of it, again, as we've seen in several other places, makes it very clear. There's not but two places where you can eternally end up. It's a one or the other scenario here. Okay? No other options here. All right? They will be left out of the inheritance. Notice the very first thing that he uses in describing this group of people is what? The cowardly. I'm not sure, I don't know where else this word is used, okay, in the Scriptures. Maybe, I just don't know where it is, if it's used. So this is a word that is, at the very least, it's not used very often, other than here that I know of. Why this word? How does this particular word fit into all of this?
I find that kind of interesting because a lot of people say that Christianity is for weak people, mm-hmm. okay? And I always say walk a day in my life because yeah. I have to watch what I do or say at all times. Mm-hmm. It's those that don't do these things are the cowards.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they are the weak-minded.
They're taking the easy way.
Exactly. And it's a battle to stay on the right track.
Yeah.
It's a constant battle. And like you said, they've taken the easy way out, so I think that would be considered, they are the cowards.
Okay.
They are the ones that don't have the courage to walk in the Christian way.
Okay. All right. Fine.
I think with the false teaching, people know what they're supposed to do, but they're not brave enough to do it.
That's it.
I think, okay, Wes, go ahead.
What comes to my mind is just saying that if you say that you are for Christ, you are afraid to stand up on him. Okay. You know, he said, you won't own me before me, and I won't own you in front of my Father. And you know, you plan to be a Christian by getting scared, and you get down to keep it. You know, I'm going to lay my religion down for a minute. I'm not strong enough or not brave enough to stand up, even if you had to stand alone. You know, that comes to my mind, and you know, you say it's about the college.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Again, go back to the beginning of our study, and we've been mentioned already a couple of times here this morning. He's writing this to encourage those who are facing the trials, the tribulations, the persecution, and so forth. And one of the things I understand that was, you know, opportunity given to folks back in the early times of persecution was denounce Christ or we're going to kill you in some terrible, horrific way. And so many would, in fear for their physical life, would denounce Christ. So they're not holding on to the faith. They're cowards. And again, we can look at that and say, you know, wow, those folks back there. But Wes, as you're saying, how many people today, because they're afraid to lose their job, they're afraid to lose their friends or their family or whatever, won't stand up for the truth, see, and would even deny the Lord? They're cowards. And I think that's what he's talking about here. And he lists them first. Okay. Anything else on that part? Okay. Now we get to see what's it going to be? What's it going to look like? Okay. Well, here is a picture of what we have to look forward to. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel. Like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great wall with 12 gates. Let me see here. I got another Okay. All right. And then on each of the gates, it had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were three gates on the east, three on the north, three on the south, and three on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations. Okay, and then it talks about measuring the city here. It had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Okay, now we have 12 gates, okay, and on the gates were written what? The names of the 12 tribes of Israel. On the foundation, we have what? The 12 apostles of the Lord. Okay. What? Well, who was it that was chosen to replace Judas? Matthias. Right?
Paul wasn't chosen.
Apparently not.
I've heard some speculation on it here. You know, we always take this to mean this is a description of where we would live.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, figuratively.
Right.
But he actually says, I'll show you the bride,
right,
the wife of the Lamb. And so I've heard speculation. He may not be describing where we would live. This may be a metaphorical description of the church.
I think so. In all its glory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why he talks about the 12 gates are what? They represent all of Israel who is saved, right? And the foundations that have the names of the 12 apostles represent what? All of the Christians who are saved. All of those who belong to Christ in terms of the Christian age. So in other words, it goes back to the same thing, I think, as, okay, what is the church? The church is all those who are saved. Okay, both of Israel and of Christ. Right, go back to the 144,000 under the altar, right? That 144,000 represented what? All of those of Israel who are saved. But after that, I looked and saw what? A great multitude that no one could count. From where? From every nation under heaven, right? So again, those are representative of the idea of the completeness, all of those who belong to the Lord. So I think you're exactly right, Dale, because that does that not represent the church, those who are saved? Okay? What that dwelling in terms of how and again, I don't know exactly how that transition. I think it's just representative of this is where all of those who belong to God are going to be and be a part of this. Because why? They're part of the saved. Right? And I think this does go in some way, it goes and describes this New Jerusalem. This is that part of the new heaven and the new earth? Yeah, I think it's part of it. Okay? The dwelling of God, as we were talking about earlier. All right? Okay, so then there is this measurement in verse 15. The angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city, its gates, and its walls. Okay? And it goes through and gives the... I found this picture on there. I don't know how well you can see that. Kind of gives an idea of just an artist's rendition. I don't know if you can see the angel. It's not going to show up on that thing. But up there in the back, the center, right where the corner of the wall is, you look above that, is an angel with a measuring rod. Okay? So the idea here of this particular picture, this angel has a measuring rod, and he says the city was laid out like a square as long as it was wide. He measured the city with the rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia. The note that I have in my footnotes in here is about 1,400 miles. Okay? and that is in length and as wide and high as it is long. Right? So that previous picture we had up there, a couple back here, basically the idea of a cube, right? 1,400 miles wide, 1,400 miles long, 1,400 miles high. Right? Literal 1,400 miles. I've seen several different depictions and pictures of folks that have taken these drawings and illustrations and put them on the globe map of the world. And then try to measure out 1,400 miles this way, 1,400 miles, and this is the area that is going to be the new Earth. Do what?
Here in Kansas City.
Yeah, okay. Well, most of these that I've seen are over in the Middle East. Gee, I wonder why that is. Okay, you know. So again, what's the message there? Is it going to be 1,200 stadia? 12 in prophecy represents what?
Completeness.
Okay? It's completeness. It is going to be, in other words, if you look at this image, it's going to be perfectly square. In other words, perfect. Okay? You ever looked at a map of even the country? And seeing, you know, the states and how they're drawn and all this. You ever wondered on the map, say, why did they draw, you know, the border line that way and divide it up that way? Wouldn't it have been easy? I mean, you look at this part of the country, and it's kind of all this, you know, and these weird shapes. You go out to the Midwest, and what are they? They're boxes, right? Everything is boxes. Go out to the plains, and it's all boxes. Everything's squared off, okay? I think here is just this idea. We're kind of used to borders that are just kind of everywhere and things aren't perfect and so forth. I think the imagery here perhaps he wants us to understand is that this is going to be complete and it's going to be perfect. Okay? Don't worry about the borders. Okay? Because it's going to encompass how far? All of God's domain, everything, wherever God dwells. Okay? Oh, man, we are out of time again. Okay. I tell you what, let's pick up here next week, round about verse 17. And I want to encourage you to read that part, read the rest of Revelation. We're going to go finish this description next week and then look at chapter 22, the final part. And I don't know if we probably won't finish it all next week. But this is a picture of to give us an idea of what we can expect in the glory of the presence of Almighty God. All right? Thank you all very much.